You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Jim Duffy. As Ronald Reagan left the Oval Office for the last time, he spoke of the shining city upon a hill. Reagan invoked that biblical metaphor to describe the United States of America. In that final address to the American people, the president described what the shining city had meant to him. "It was a tall, proud city," he began, "built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds, living in harmony and peace. A city with free ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here." "And how stands the city on this winter night?" Reagan asked. Well, here to answer that question on this winter night, some 40 years later, is one of America's foremost constitutional legal scholars, Professor David D. Cole, who joins me now from Washington. Thank you for coming on to the podcast, David.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
David Cole is professor in law and public policy at Georgetown University. Last year, he stood down after 6 years as the National Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. He's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and has for many years been the legal affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. You're joining us from Washington, David, as I say, having just returned from London, where you delivered the Bar Council's annual International Rule of Law lecture. And you were describing an American constitutional system under strain.
Yeah, well, that's to be sure. That's putting it mildly. Since President Trump took office, he has undertaken just a remarkable number of unprecedented measures which challenge the core concepts of checks and balances, separation of powers, fealty to constitutional principles, and the like. I mean, it started with things like eliminating, firing all the inspectors general in the executive branch. They're the people who oversee complaints about fraud, abuse, misuse of government power. He says, let's get rid of them all. He then fired anyone who was involved in any kind of investigation of his own criminal activities, even if they were simply doing their job at the time. And he put in place at the heads of all the critical agencies, people whose principal qualification for the job was loyalty to Donald Trump, not expertise in the workings of that agency, but fealty to Donald Trump alone. And then he has used and abused the Justice Department, which is supposed to be doing justice, as a tool to target his enemies, prosecuting people like former FBI Director James Comey, simply because Comey investigated potential Russian interference in the first election in which Trump came to office. And similarly, prosecuting the Attorney General of New York State, Letitia James, simply because she investigated and prosecuted his companies in New York for crimes. Those companies were, in fact, found guilty, as he was found guilty of crime in New York. So he has turned the executive branch into a tool of his own will, often seeming to be more interested in lining his own pockets than in doing the job. And then the last thing I'll mention is the pardons of all the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, when Congress was set to announce the results of the election that Donald Trump lost. They stormed the Capitol. Several police officers died in the course of that. Hundreds and hundreds of people were convicted for blatantly illegal conduct. Trump comes into office and the first thing he does is pardon them all, including those who engaged in violent attacks on police officers.
there are pressure points all over the place then in terms of where this strain is coming from, and you've given us a survey of many of those, and there were two in particular that you focused on when you gave your remarks earlier this week: the use of emergency powers first, and second, the attacks by the Trump administration on civil society. I wonder if we can just start by unpacking the first of those a little, because Donald Trump is a president who, from I guess day one of term one, has made the most, shall we say, of his executive powers. He's not known to be a consensus builder, not a man to reach across the aisle. He is attracted to his executive orders, his prerogative powers, and he's particularly adept at invoking emergency powers. And to be fair, he's not the first US president to utilize rather liberally those special powers vested in his office, is he?
No. And the reason I spoke about emergency powers in civil society at my lecture for the Bar Council is because I think they are so central to the challenges facing the rule of law in the United States. Because almost by definition, emergency power puts some pressure on the rule of law. People say necessity knows no law. It's an emergency. We need to do what needs to be done. Law, you know, it just gets in the way, is the sensibility. And that's not just in the United States. That's in many countries. In times of war, in times of real national crisis, the executive tends to get more powers. The limits on those powers tend to be much less enforced, if enforced at all. And so, you know, we saw Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War suspend the writ of habeas corpus. We saw during World War I, Congress made it a crime to speak out against the war, and over 1,000 people went to jail, many of them for 10-year sentences, merely for protesting the war. In World War II, we saw Franklin Delano Roosevelt authorize the internment of 110,000 people of Japanese descent, about 70,000 of them U.S. citizens, based not on any actual evidence that they posed a threat of espionage or sabotage, but simply because they were of Japanese descent on the basis of race. You know, and then after 9/11, we saw George Bush authorize torture, waterboarding, disappearances into secret black sites. And all of those were exercises of emergency power. None of those were struck down by the courts. In fact, the courts upheld those actions. So emergency power poses a real threat to the rule of law, because in an emergency, people feel like, hey, you know, the rule of law, that's a luxury. We can't afford that when we are facing an existential crisis.
Yeah. And I guess in Lincoln's case, in FDR's case, they at least had the emergency. The emergency existed. The Civil War was happening. World War II was happening. When we come now to Trump, he has declared various emergencies, hasn't he? Notably by using first an old statute called the Alien Enemies Act.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing about the prior uses of emergencies is that they were during actual wars, or in the case of George W. Bush, a terrorist attack of unprecedented proportions in which 3,000 people were killed and the organization was threatening to do further damage.
Yeah.
But with President Trump, there is no emergency. We are not under attack. There is no war going on. And yet he is exercising the same kind of emergency authorities, asserting the same kind of powers. And yeah, the Alien Enemies Act is a prime example of that. That's a statute that goes back to 1798. It says when we are at war with a nation, the executive can detain or deport somebody simply because they're a citizen of that nation. It doesn't have to really show anything more than that. It was used during World War I. It was used during World War II. England had a similar practice during World War I and World War II, but it hasn't been used since World War II in the United States. And we are not in a war, much less a world war. What President Trump has said is that an organization, Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang, is attacking us. Now, nobody ever heard of Tren de Aragua until President Trump made this really ridiculous claim that they are attacking us. But he has asserted that they are attacking us and that therefore we are under armed attack, that they are somehow working with Venezuela to do this, to attack us, even though there's no evidence that they've actually shot anyone or invaded or anything, and that therefore he can deport people from Venezuela without any determination that they violated any of our immigration laws. And he sought to deport over 100, just less than 200 Venezuelans on that authority back in March. A court ordered him not to. He nonetheless went ahead and sent several plane loads down to a horrific prison in El Salvador. That policy is now on hold because the Supreme Court, many lower courts have said it's illegal, and the Supreme Court has said you can't use this authority any further until we determine whether it's appropriately invoked here. But it's clearly not appropriately invoked here. We are not at war. We haven't declared war with Venezuela. Venezuela hasn't attacked us. And so the Alien Enemies Act has no application. And yet the president, by saying it so, acts as if he has these war powers to deploy.
When studying the US system from the outside, one of the first things we learn about are these checks and balances that you referenced at the start of the podcast, checks and balances that are designed to limit otherwise limitless power. And starting with the political aspect of that, so elected representatives, to what extent has there been a sustained political attempt to scrutinize Trump's deployment of the Alien Enemies Act against Venezuelans?
Virtually none. And that's because both houses of Congress are controlled by the Republicans. They have a very small majority in both houses, but that means they control all of the committees in Congress, who are the institutions that would conduct any sort of inquiry. So the Democrats might well want to have an inquiry into why President Trump is invoking this law where it is clearly not applicable, but the Republicans just block that. And the Republicans have no interest in questioning the president. So the only place you can question the president is in the courts. And indeed, many, many people subjected to this have filed suits, many of them represented by the ACLU. And the courts have, by and large, said this is unauthorized, still being litigated through appeals in the lower courts. It will eventually get to the Supreme Court, but it is a clearly bogus invocation of an emergency power. But for a court to push back, it requires the court to say, we call your bluff, President Trump. We can say this is not a war. Mm-hmm. And the president will argue, and has argued, number one, it is a war because I say so. But number two, courts have no authority to second guess my determination that we are in an armed conflict. That's my call as president. Courts have no authority to review that. Well, if that's the case, then there is no check on the president, because as we've talked about, Congress has no interest in checking him. And if the courts can't check him, he is exercising unlimited power.
But so far, the courts have face down those sorts of justiciability arguments, have they?
Yes, they have.
They are at least standing up to the administration on these deportations.
Yeah. Almost every judge who has looked at it has rejected President Trump's claims. A couple of judges have, maybe even just one, have gone the other way, but it is now being considered by the most conservative court of appeals in the country, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, by the entire en banc court. And we'll see what they say, but it will go to the Supreme Court. And not until it gets to the Supreme Court will President Trump actually be able to use it, because in the course of the one of the adjudications, the Supreme Court said, hey, President Trump, do not seek to deport any more people under this law until we decide that it's authorized. And they did that because they saw what happened when a district court ordered him not to deport people, and he simply sent them on their way in direct defiance of that order.
I mean, we hear about Trump every day of the week, every time we turn on the television, every main news page, he is somewhere on that page. Trump in Ukraine, Trump in the Middle East, Trump and Epstein, Trump pardoning a turkey ahead of Thanksgiving. he's absolutely everywhere. But it's striking how that barrage of news coverage can often obscure the really big things that are happening, and things that if they happened 10 years ago would dominate, you would imagine, the news cycle for weeks. And one of those things is action purportedly against Latin American drug cartels on the high seas.
Yeah, and this is really kind of a doubling down on the Alien Enemies Act theory. As many of your listeners will know, President Trump has asserted the authority not just to deport and detain people who are said to be associated with Venezuelan drug gang, but to execute them, to summarily execute them on the seas from the air. And he started this in September, and at this point, he has killed over 80 people in over 20 strikes on boats that are said to be running drugs from Venezuela or other parts of Latin America to the United States. They are often fishing boats. There is no evidence that they're actually carrying drugs, because what the United States does is bombs them to smithereens from the air so that there is no evidence. The evidence is at the bottom of the sea. And what we've recently learned is that they not only are bombing these boats out of existence, but in one of the instances on September 2nd, the first assault left two people alive clinging to debris from the boat that had been destroyed. And the military went back in to kill the survivors, to kill people who were simply holding on for dear life, a clear, patent violation of the laws of war. You cannot go in and kill the survivors. And that's exactly what they did. But the whole thing is illegal. You cannot kill drug smugglers or people on boats simply because you think they're smuggling drugs. If you think they're smuggling drugs, you can interdict them. The Coast Guard does that, has done that frequently over the course of our history. And what it does then is bring them to shore, charge them, try them. And if they're convicted, they can be sentenced to serve many, many years in prison. But they cannot be executed. You cannot be executed in the United States unless you commit a homicide or are involved in a homicide. And yet what President Trump is doing is no arrest, no trial, no conviction, imposition of the death penalty from the air.
And you've referred to war crimes, but in reality, in this scenario, that would have to presuppose that there was a war.
Yeah.
And as you would say, there isn't one. So we don't even have the veneer of legality that we might start to get into if there was a war, because these are, in fact, just extrajudicial killings.
Yeah. Another word for it would be murder.
Yeah.
And there are federal statutes, U.S. federal statutes, that make it murder to kill people on the high seas. And that is exactly what President Trump and Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth and all the people who are carrying out his orders are doing.
These are the sorts of things that we might, again, if I think back about 10 years, we might expect to read about happening in far-flung places around the world. So we had Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines and his war on drugs and extrajudicial killing on a pretty industrial scale. It was something that despots did. And now America's engaged in this sort of attack on the high seas. But again, it seems, at least from the outside, that it's not to a particularly significant degree of opprobrium or of international condemnation. I know there will be sections of civil society that are condemning it and so on, but I haven't seen any particularly firm statements at an international level. Is that because of a weakening of international organizations like the UN? Is it because of the diplomatic tightrope that foreign leaders are walking when it comes to keeping Trump on side on other issues? What's going on?
It is absolutely indefensible, outrageous conduct, and should be condemned by every country, every organization. If we're going to allow the leaders of democratic countries or non-democratic countries to simply declare war on anybody and then start killing people from the air, we no longer have a civilized society. So why aren't we hearing more opprobrium? I don't know, but I speculate that people are afraid, that countries are afraid of getting on Trump's bad side because he's exercising economic sanctions authority, also on the basis of a bogus invocation of emergency powers. And so they're hoping that maybe he won't impose a really drastic tariff on imports from their country. You know, we're seeing this in the United States too, with corporations kowtowing to the president, getting rid of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, not because they're illegal, but because President Trump doesn't like them. And they're worried that if President Trump puts that corporation in his sights, he can do a lot of damage, he can hurt it. And he's shown that he is willing to do that. That's how he operates. So my suspicion is that the world is chilled in much the way that many institutions in the United States have been chilled from speaking out and speaking the truth.
That economic aspect is the one further emergency power aspect I wanted to look at, because it's perhaps of the most immediate consequence to people outside America, Trump's declaration of an economic emergency. And that all revolves, doesn't it, around the International Emergency Economic Powers Act.
Yeah, and that is a statute that essentially says that the president can declare an emergency. And then once he declares an emergency, he can use a set of economic tools to respond to that emergency. And it comes out of something called the Trading with the Enemy Act. The sort of model is we're in diplomatic struggle with a country like Cuba or a country like Iran, and we impose an economic embargo on that country. No one in the United States can do business with that country. It's a way of putting pressure on the country. But the law was written somewhat broadly, and it has been used not just to put sanctions on countries, but to put sanctions on alleged terrorist organizations, on Russian oligarchs, even on the International Criminal Court, shamefully, by this president. And he, in the most expansive use of this power in its 50 years in existence, he has declared that the trade deficit in the United States is a national emergency, and on the basis of that, has asserted the power to impose tariffs on imports from every last nation in the world, even if they've done nothing to us. And that, too, has been challenged in the courts. And the Supreme Court heard argument on it just a month or so ago. And it's always hard to predict from the questions and arguments, but it certainly seemed that there were at least four votes that are very, very skeptical of the president's authority, and two others that seemed quite skeptical. We'll see what we ultimately get. But if he wins, he'll eke out a 5-4 win. And I think it's more likely that he loses by a vote of 5-4 or 6-3, in which the courts say, the powers that Congress gave you are restricted. They do not mention tariffs. Tariffs are a form of tax. The Constitution gave Congress the power to tax, not the president. And so for the president to unilaterally impose tariffs that have now raised hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes, which ultimately American consumers have paid, violates the separation of powers.
I think one of the points you were making the other night, David, in your lecture was the fact that there are ways in which the courts can adjudicate on these issues without getting into the question whether there is an emergency or isn't an emergency. So perhaps they could, for example, say, well, this is a taxation issue and therefore it's for Congress. It's not for us in the Supreme Court to adjudicate upon. But in order to be an effective bulwark against executive overreach, the courts have to call a spade, don't they? They have to call this out. They have to be prepared to say there is no emergency. Otherwise, you end up in a situation where the judiciary starts to risk becoming part of the problem.
Yeah, so I think that's certainly the case with respect to the Alien Enemies Act. The core question in that case is, are we at war? I think the courts have to answer that question. In the context of this particular dispute, there are two questions. One, is there an emergency? But the second question is, even if there's an emergency, did the powers that Congress gave the president to use during an emergency include the power to impose a tariff on the entire world?
Yeah.
And I think they can rule on the latter question without ruling on whether the trade deficit constitutes an emergency.
And I guess a majority on the Supreme Court might be more likely to coalesce around the former and perhaps not the latter.
They're certainly more likely to say, yes, that the tariff authority is not there, because all that requires really is reading the statute.
Yeah.
The statute doesn't use the term tariff. Other statutes do. It doesn't require second guessing the president on his assertion that there is a national emergency. Whereas under the Alien Enemies Act, really the only question is there an emergency or not? Because if we're at war with another nation, then the statute allows us to deport people from that nation. And there's no other condition, really. The only question is, are we in fact at war?
Much of what you're describing in terms of what Trump has done in his first term, but perhaps more strikingly in his second term, involves him using levers to quite a large extent that already exist within the US Constitution. He's invoking longstanding legislation. He might be invoking it in a questionable way or a false way. He's relying on a Supreme Court that he and past presidents have packed and been allowed to pack with people sympathetic to their arguments. He's been handing out the pardons that you mentioned at the start to whoever he likes, but that's a fairly unfettered power, isn't it, of an American president? So one might say that a constitutional system founded on checks and balances has, to some extent, created this sort of situation. It might not have expected in the 21st century to be faced with a kind of Donald Trump figure, but he's using tools that were always there to be abused if anybody wanted to.
Well, to some degree, that's right. I mean, that's always the risk with emergency power. And often people say, you know, look, on the one hand, you do need extraordinary authorities to meet extraordinary threats. And it probably makes sense to have Parliament or Congress lay out what those authorities should be. But the risk is that they will be abused by executive officials who find them useful, even in the absence of an emergency. So oftentimes emergencies, you know, get declared, arise, and then the authorities that are deployed in response to that emergency never end. They last for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. So,
sure.
So that's a problem. But another problem, and I think the problem that we're seeing with President Trump, is that unless there's going to be a real check on the ability to claim that something is an emergency, if Arsenal lost last week, is that a national emergency? If the president says that's a national emergency, surely a court has to be able to say, no, Arsenal losing, that might be a tragedy, but it's not an emergency. And that, I think, unless courts can say that, and unless people say that, and unless Congress says that, you basically hand the president a blank check.
So we come then, David, to the second point that you're concerned about, and that is the series of attacks upon civil society, the Associated Press being frozen out of the Oval Office, press pool, cutting funding to universities. They might seem like some petty microaggressions on one level, but you would argue that from a rule of law perspective, they have to be taken seriously.
Absolutely. I think one of the critical elements of the rule of law, maybe not always emphasized by philosophers of the rule of law, but in practice, absolutely essential, is a robust civil society, by which I mean institutions that people create that are not governmental, that can speak out and fight back and criticize what the government is doing. So, you know, when you look around the world, lots of countries have constitutions that look great on paper, don't look great in practice, and oftentimes they don't have very strong civil society institutions. The civil society institutions in the United States are protected by the First Amendment. It protects the right to associate, to advocate. That's what NGOs do, non-governmental organizations. It protects academic freedom, the universities and colleges. It protects the press. It protects the right to march in the streets, the right to assembly. It protects the right to file lawsuits, petition for redress of grievance. It protects the right of religious institutions. And that really is civil society. What we have seen since Trump took office is a concerted effort to attack those institutions of civil society, not unlike autocrats in other countries. And I think it's in large part because that's where resistance comes from. That's how people come together and effectively respond to and push back against abuse. And so he's targeted the universities, he's targeted the press, he's targeted lawyers and law firms. He's not yet taken action, but he's threatened to take action against NGOs. He sought to undermine unions in very fundamental ways. And all of these are institutions that he sees as not aligned with him and as the places where people go to speak out and come together in defense of the principles that he's attacking.
The front that he's opened against civil society, it's to a large extent been based on defunding, hasn't it, rather than direct legal action, for example?
Much of it has, and I think that's in part because if he took direct legal action, there would be very quick constitutional challenges. And so where he has taken direct action, there have been very quick constitutional actions. He went after a number of law firms because he didn't like the lawsuits they filed and the partners they hired. And the law firms that challenged his actions, that went into court, immediately got injunctions against it. Clear, blatant violation of the First Amendment. You cannot punish a law firm because it files a lawsuit against you. That is just about as core a violation of the Constitution as you can get. And so, you know, he hasn't succeeded there. But a lot of our civil society institutions are dependent on government support, government funding, government research grants to universities, government support to the press, government approval of media mergers, and all of these things are much softer. They're harder to constrain and limit. And he's used them to essentially try to coerce entities into not speaking out, not acting against him for fear of losing that support, not getting their merger approved, or not getting next year's research grants. And these research grants to universities can be hundreds of millions of dollars. So we're talking about serious, serious threats to the continuing existence of these institutions.
Yeah. So they are kowtowing, as you said, but I guess money talks. And if these threats are posing existential challenges, then these organizations might say they basically have no choice.
I think they have a choice. You know, some of the organizations do say we have no choice, but I think, you always have a choice. And it's illustrated by the fact that he's gone after a number of universities. Harvard is suing.
Yeah.
They are not settling. They are suing. He went after a bunch of law firms. A bunch of them, 9 law firms, settled with him and agreed, among other things, to provide him with almost $1 billion of free legal services for causes that he cares about. But 4 law firms said, no way, we're going to court. What you're doing is illegal. And they got injunctions immediately. So I think entities do have a choice. And the choice is existential, I think, in a broader sense, not necessarily for that institution, but for our democracy, for what civil society looks like going forward. Do the organizations stand down or fight back? And I will say that there are many organizations that are fighting back. The ACLU, I was the national legal director of the ACLU. I'm now back in the academy, but it is suing President Trump at every stage. And it is not the only one. There are hundreds of lawsuits against the president, over 150 injunctions from courts against presidential initiatives. So people are fighting back. There are college presidents who are speaking out bravely. There are far too many that are ducking and covering, hoping that they won't get singled out. But I don't want people to be under the misimpression that everybody in America is just shutting up and I'm the only one speaking out. There are many people speaking out and pushing back.
You spoke earlier about George W. Bush's declaration of an emergency, the war on terror. There was quite a long period before his administration where, I guess, looking back, things were quite conventional by comparison to the days that we're now living in. But then under George W. Bush, we had rendition flights, CIA, black sites, Guantanamo, the idea of enemy combatants, and all the rest of it. And notably, a sidelining of the UN charter processes in order to invade Iraq. In hindsight, all of that seems to have been an especially important precursor to what we're seeing now, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's what one of the things people said back then was war on terror, it's a tactic, it's not an organization. And so once you start justifying war-type activities on a tactic, when does it end? When does it end? And you are creating precedents that can be used by others to worse ends. And I think that's what we're seeing under President Trump.
You were at Yale as a student when Reagan delivered that speech about the shining city upon the hill. Since then, you've been in legal practice, academia, and been a leader in civil society. From your perspective then, David, how stands the city on this winter night?
Well, you know, I think I've never seen it challenged like it is challenged right now. I've never seen a president engage in the kind of conduct that President Trump has engaged in, a Congress that is as supine as the Congress is today, a court that is very, very conservative. And so, you know, while it will check the president on some matters, it will probably let him get away with a lot of other matters. And so it's a very disturbing time, a very disturbing time. But I guess what I would say is the proof will be in the pudding. The proof will be in what happens in the midterm elections, which will come up next November. What happens in another 3 years when we have the presidential election? Will this period be sort of the first step on a path towards authoritarianism and sort of the demise of constitutional democracy in the United States? Or will it be seen as an object lesson in how not to be a president? And if it's seen in the latter vein, then I think what we'll see is somebody with a very different set of perspectives and values elected the next time around, a Congress with very different sets of values and perspectives elected, and substantial reforms enacted to respond to the kinds of abuses that President Trump has illustrated. But that will only happen. That will only happen if people stand up, fight back, go out into the streets, work in civil society organizations to say, this is not my America. And that's why he's targeting civil society. And that's precisely why civil society has to push back.
Professor David D. Cole, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.